You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Hello, and welcome back to Mysteries and Monsters. On this episode, I welcome back authors and investigators Chad Lewis and Kevin Lee Nelson, alongside filmmaker Joe Turie, to dive into the mysterious case of Murfreesboro's Big Muddy Monster. Joe has recently released a brilliant documentary, Creature from Big Muddy, an Illinois Bigfoot legend, looking at this unusual case. With eyewitness interviews and location visits, Chad and Kevin lead us on the hunt for this enigmatic cryptid. Whilst the main flap occurred in the early 1970s, alongside a rather terrifying standoff in 1988, the Big Muddy Monster seems to be one of those cyclical cryptids, reappearing every few years to cause fear and panic to the residents of Murfreesboro. We chat about the film, some of the key encounters, and ponder the possible explanations for a wave of sightings. With the town of Murfreesboro embracing their cryptid legend, this is one story you need to know more about. It was a pleasure to welcome Chad and Kevin back and to speak with Joe about his brilliant film, which you can now rent on Amazon Prime. As always, you can support the show by signing up for Patreon via the show notes for $4 a month. You can find us across all social media platforms. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and you can subscribe to our channel on YouTube. We've also now got a website, which you can find at mysteriesandmonsters.com. Artwork for the show, as always, is by Dean Bestel. The show is produced by Brennan Stahl of the Ghost Story Guys. And Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. Okay, put on those waders, flashlights at the ready, as we join Kevin, Chad and Joe on the hunt for Big Muddy. Today on Mysteries and Monsters, we're off on the hunt for Murfreesboro's infamous Big Muddy Monster. Joining me on this curious cryptid hunt are filmmaker Joe Tully, alongside Chad Lewis and Kevin Lee Nelson. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having us.
Now then, Joe, your documentary, Creature from Big Muddy, an Illinois Bigfoot legend, has just hit all the VOD streams around the world. Fabulous documentary, as I've said. Really enjoyed it. And I have to say, when I'm watching it, when it started, I was struck immediately how beautifully shot it is. It looks fabulous. I love the titles, with all the strange graphics flying about and the little images in between all the names of everybody's in there. So what was it for you, Joe, that's brought you into this very strange creature story?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for all the compliments. I appreciate that. You know, I've always been fascinated with weird stories and fun stories. I think cryptids are probably my favorite type of weird story. And I was just searching for something local. Like, basically, I live in Illinois, so I didn't want to travel too far because I'm just a beginning filmmaker and I don't have a big crew or anything like that. So I was just searching for stories within Illinois, and I stumbled across Kevin and Chad and Noah Voss's book, The Big Muddy Monster. And it has a white Bigfoot on the front, so that immediately grabbed my attention. Even though I'm only a couple hours from the area, like, I never really heard the story before. So just researching their book a little bit, it really intrigued me. And I thought, this would be a fantastic story to do a documentary on if it was, you know, feasible. So yeah, that kind of just the oddness of it and the fact that it's not a super popular, well-known story unless you're like in the hardcore Bigfoot community really grabbed my attention.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, Kevin and Chad, it's one of those stories that it seems that you two were both aware of it, and when you read the book, it seems like you keep having the opportunity to get round to investigating it, and it seemed to just keep pulling itself away from you for about a decade. And then I think you were looking into the Squawker case, and it was that way you just finally went, well, we're only a couple of hours away, let's just get this out of the way.
Yeah, that's true. We both, Chad and I, were aware of the Big Muddy Monster legend for quite a while, and you know, we knew that it was kind of unique, but at the time we didn't really know how deep the legend went and really how much there was to it. You know, we figured, oh, maybe it's just a number of sightings in the mid-70s and that was about it, you know, maybe a little bit in the 80s. But the more we researched it and kept, you know, interviewing people and digging deeper, the more we found that this was actually a much, much broader and bigger legend than we ever imagined. And during that research phase, you know, we would kind of do some work on it and then shelve it for a bit and then come back to it. And then it kind of went back and forth a number of times, and it ended up being a good thing to do because we kept finding more and more stuff as we allowed a little bit more time to pass. You know, more things would kind of come to the surface that if we kind of rushed the whole thing in the beginning, we might have overlooked. So it kind of worked out in our favor that way.
Yeah, fantastic. I mean, what I was struck by as well is, once again, it seems to be one of those cases where most people would seem to concentrate on what happened at the beginning of the 70s over that period between 72 and 75, I think, where you had obviously the most notable sightings. And yet, once again, it's one of those situations where as soon as you start looking into it, you think, oh, well, hang on, there was something happening here in 1915. There's something happened here in 1929. You've got a couple of incidents in the 1940s, and then it reappears in the 1950s. So was that a case of once you dove into where you thought the ground zero was in the early 70s, the other stories all suddenly appeared? Or was it a case of you kind of knew a little bit about some of the earlier stuff, and then it came to light? Or was it all new, everything predating what we would consider the Big Muddy's key part?
Yeah, for me, I think it was having a view, a knowledge of the creature in general, that this giant Bigfoot-looking white beast had been seen. But as Kevin mentioned earlier, didn't quite know the extent of how far back it went. And one of the areas that fascinates me the most now is how cryptids, especially, some become almost celebrity cryptids, and how even cases among cryptids get well known when more fascinating ones are left to the dust of history. So I'm always amazed that when you start looking into these things, you almost always find that they have a much longer and much more bizarre history than you did when you started out.
Paul, are you familiar with Momo?
Yes, I am. Obviously, it was one of those where I'd heard of it when I was a young chap, and then I only kind of reignited my knowledge of it was obviously when the Small Town Monsters documentary came out. So that was a very interesting, and once again, I only knew a bit of the story. I didn't know the extent of everything else that was going on. So yeah,
that's what's kind of what Chad was talking about. Momo happened just 2 or 3 hour drive from Murfreesboro, and basically in the 73 time period. Even I heard of Momo when I was a kid, and that's farther away from me. And kind of funny how Momo became the celebrity and poor old Big Muddy just kind of fell to the wayside.
You know, I think a lot of it's just dumb luck. You know, it's what story gets picked up by a major paper or a news coverage. You know, it's less so the merit of the case and more just dumb luck.
Well, that's funny too, because the Big Muddy actually went global for a while, and you know, nationwide, New York Times and people, like we say in the movie, someone from Russia came and talked to one of the witnesses. So but then it just disappeared, which is super odd to me.
Yeah, it is surprising how certain things just drop out of favor, like you say there, because there seems to be this initial kind of explosion of interest, and it travels around the world and gets printed in major newspapers. And as you say, you even have guys coming over from Russia, which they didn't do for Momo, so that's one for Big Muddy Monster straight away, isn't it, there? So right. clearly there was a bit more. But the thing I find intriguing about this whole span of experiences throughout the area is that when you have the cases from, I think, 1915 in Creole Springs, and then 1928, 1929, you've got, once again, we've got something going around killing dogs that is allegedly a panther, and yet we don't have a panther, and then the newspapers say it's some kind of weird wolf dog thing. Well, I don't know. I wouldn't say I'm an expert on panthers, but I know they don't look like dogs. So you start getting these problems where these things are going on over a... It's like every 15 years from 1915 onwards, something weird turns up. And you begin to think, well, is Murfreesboro one of Kiel's famous window areas?
It's a possibility. That's one of the arguments that we talk about in the book is, you know, because there's so many strange things that happen down there. And it's not just cryptids. It's anything from UFO sightings, ghost lights, you name it. A lot of haunted houses that follow various patterns, and they call them spirit corridors or paranormal corridors down there. You know, so is there something about the lay of the land or the land itself that's generating this odd phenomena, or is that phenomena attracted to this location for some reason? You know, no one really knows, but, you know, there is a preponderance of just strange activity and sightings in that area of southern Illinois, the extreme southern tip of Illinois, that goes back, you know, 100 years and beyond.
Yeah, I mean, what I found very interesting as well is that we've got this creature, or what is it, or some of those wonderful names that they all come up in some of the older newspapers, where they just the thingy-me-jig or whatever, you know, they call it. It's just some strange things that they just pull together. And out of everything that goes on that predates what we would know as the Big Muddy Flap, as it were, the creature that people see in the 40s seems to me to be the only one that's quite similar to it. I think the one in the 60s maybe as well. But the other thing that strikes me about the creature in the 40s is these weird ears that people point out. They look like they're on top of the head, like a dog. Whereas everything else that we know about what Big Muddy was supposed to be, it tends to be your more typical Bigfoot kind of report, which is a very interesting thing. But yet again, it's a silvery white creature.
It is. I think that's the puzzling thing about the 1940s, when they called it the thing because they simply didn't know what to call it. Giant 8, 9, 10 foot silver haired monster. And people couldn't even agree on what it looked like back then, from people swearing that it was a bear to a wolf again. And of course, they often fell into the category that it had to be an escapee from a circus or carnival that had been passing through. Perhaps even a tiger was on the loose. So they tried to explain it in the best manner they could at that time, but they really had no idea what they were dealing with when the livestock was found with their heads torn apart and partially devoured and the blood drained and sucked from the neck of these animals. They were terrified. At night, they refused to go out alone because they were afraid of they might be the next victim.
I think some of that has to do with people not... You know, the term Bigfoot didn't come out until the Jerry Crew days. So when was that? Was that late 50s or something like that? So maybe people just didn't know exactly what to call it or had no other reference to go by.
Yeah, I mean, that is an interesting part of your documentary as well, because obviously, for balance, Joe, you have to have a couple of people that want to spoil everybody's fun from the skeptical camp. I'm only joking. You've got to have a bit of balance regardless. But
right.
It's very interesting that the folklorist, I've forgotten the gentleman's name, says, oh, yeah, people were putting on shoes to create fake footprints and stuff, which I found a really odd thing for somebody to say, because that's not something that we're really aware of that predates, as you say, you know, the late 50s when Bigfoot first appears. And then after that, everybody's apparently running around the country with false prints on their shoes just for a laugh. Whereas for one of these cases that kind of predates all that post-1958 Bigfoot explosion when Bigfoot hits the mainstream, this is one of the first cases where I've ever heard somebody try and take that excuse backwards. Because as Chad says, it's always something's escaped from the circus. It's a gorilla, it's an ape, and it's like a running joke in American cryptid stories. The amount of circus trains that crash in America. If I worked in a circus, the last thing I'd be doing is getting on a train. You know?
Right.
So when you were diving into this, Joe, did you come across more fantastical explanations? Because often the explanations can be as crazy as the witness reports, I find.
That's a good point. That was John Musgrave was the historian that was talking about that. And he's a folklorist as well. And he knows a lot about the area. And he's a fantastic person. But, you know, I didn't really talk to too many people that didn't believe it, or, you know, skeptic wise. Tony Girard's another one who, he's actually a huge fan of Bigfoot and a researcher, but he doesn't believe in it either. Mm. But Coyote Chris Sutton, who's a shaman in Southern Illinois, he talks more about the kind of like the woo theory of Bigfoot. Mm. And I'm a big skeptic. I'm not really a Bigfoot believer. I love the stories. I believe in the possibility, and I hope that it is true. Mm. But you know, I don't let my theories get in the way of what I'm trying to film. But I almost feel like some of the explanations, the hoaxing explanations, are just as unbelievable as the explanation of a physical creature.
Yeah, and I spoke with people that recalled there being hoaxed footprints of some sort in the 1980s and possibly the late 1970s era, but I have not spoken with anyone or found any indication that they were prior to that time frame, that people in the 1920s were walking around making these foot casts. And you find that in all legends, that often people come out of the woodwork claiming that they're responsible for the legend. And what you usually find is that they may be responsible for a sighting or an encounter, but they're certainly not responsible for the legend, that oftentimes these legends predate that by hundreds of years. So they might have hoaxed something or tried to pull a practical joke, but it certainly only added to the legend. It didn't create it.
And more to Chad's point, too, you know, a lot of people, when they hear these legends for the first time, they just assume that they're relatively recent. You know, so if they're going to go out and hoax, they're going to think that, oh, well, you know, I'm going to keep this going. And then later when they come out and say that they're the hoaxer, they think that they originated the legend. But usually they have no idea how much further back these stories go.
And I've never encountered people that have evidence of their hoax, that so many people told me they had the footprints from their grandfather or their father, usually a male that was out there doing it. But those have been lost, and there's no photos of them doing it. There's nothing left behind, no evidence whatsoever, which doesn't mean it didn't happen. But it just is kind of weird that there's not one speck of evidence to support that they did hoax any sighting.
Yeah, I think that's always interesting, that often when we have these cases, it's amazing to me that there always seems to be somebody who's one of the greatest special effects artists in the world that just happens to be hanging around the town. And like you say, there is notable aspect to this story once again is, and several people mention it in the documentary, Joe, as well, you know, this is hunting country. This is not the kind of place where you go running about scaring people, because you're liable to get your head blown off.
Absolutely. That's a really good point. And for sure, I mean, it's, if you watch the film or read the book, it's a big wilderness down there. Like, people think Illinois, they think Chicago, or they think agriculture, But in Southern Illinois is a totally different biodiverse atmosphere. There's canyons, there's heavily old growth wooded areas, there's swamps.
Nearly every single person we talked to that was there during the height of the sightings in the 1970s, when we brought up the idea that it was a person in a costume as a hoax, they all laughed at us. They said it was the Wild West back then. People were walking through the woods heavily armed. Several of the people we interviewed in the 2000s were armed when we interviewed them. So the 1970s, they said you'd have to be a complete idiot to be walking around. You would have been shot on sight because everyone was so heavily armed. And that again, that doesn't mean that people weren't foolish enough to do it.
Yeah.
But usually if you're getting shot at by the second night, you probably stay home on your hoax.
yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Because this place is so wild, like hunters are... Everybody carries a gun. They all love to hunt down there. That's like one of the main passions of people that live in Southern Illinois, and there's plenty of places to hunt. So, yeah, taking your life in your own hands if you're dressing up in a suit, for sure.
Very true. And I think the other aspect of this is whenever you get a story like this, you get people coming in from out of town and out of state who are also usually packing and come in for a bit of fun because they want to be the person that bags whatever this is running about. So living in the UK, it's a completely alien situation that people are out there hunting on a regular basis. But in certain states, like you say, Joe, that's what people do for recreation. They spend their entire weekends, you know, they work Monday to Friday, and then weekends they're out there trying to bag some food, trying to bag some game, doing it for sport, whatever kind of recreational fun they want to get. That's what they do. So good luck to anybody who wants to kind of go running about with it. You might as well run about with a target on your back.
Absolutely. And like I said, I'm a big skeptic. I really am. But one of the things about the hoax story is it's at least 7 foot tall, and other people say 8 or whatever the witnesses say. So how do you fake that? How do you fake 7 foot tall? I mean, I'm sure, yeah, we all know there's people that are pretty tall, but that's just kind of crazy to me.
Yeah, I'm not sure Illinois is a hotbed of NBA recruitment either, you know. If it was, I think every scout in the NBA would be down there if everybody in that area of Illinois is running about 7 foot tall. I mean, what are they feeding them down there?
Right.
The other side of that too is, you know, keep in mind this is the 1970s. You know, how believable of a costume could they have possibly made in the 1970s? I mean, they would have had far less at their disposal than we have now to make something even halfway believable. So, I mean, I don't think that people were any more gullible then than they are now. If anything, probably the reverse. But, you know, for people to look at this thing and think that it is something real, something that's dangerous and not just some yahoo in a costume, you know, makes you wonder.
Yeah. Plus the other aspect of this is, like I say, these are people that go out hunting. So they know what's in the woods. They know it might be a bear from a certain angle. But once again, we're talking about something that's white as well. We're not talking about atypical bear. So are we supposed to presume that Southern Illinois has got some kind of albino bear on the loose? And even so, that's as rare as an 8 foot biped running about, to be fair, because I can't remember the last time I saw an albino bear in the northern United States. You know what I mean? So unless somebody had a pet polar bear that they decided to let loose, once again, you're kind of thinking, well, that doesn't make sense. And as Kevin says there, we often kind of look back at people and think, oh, they're so gullible in the old days, they'd believe anything. But these people, some of them, it was hunting that they relied on to eat. So I find it very difficult that these people's eyesight was that bad that they would be going out with guns trying to bag their food for their families and misidentify something which clearly didn't look like anything else in the area at that time.
Paul, you're making me more of a believer. Your explanations sound pretty logical to me.
Yeah, well, I'll not tell you. Kevin and Chad have bribed me, Joe. That's what it is. But I like to, you know, balance the conversation when I'm thinking about plausible explanations, because, as you refer to, you've got to be skeptical. And as Kevin and Chad have dealt with lots and lots of cases where, you know, the squawker that I mentioned earlier on that eventually led them back to Murfreesboro is a prime example of it's supposed to be a mystery creature. But because Chad and Kevin and Noah are so forensic in their investigations, more often than not, they will turn it out that it's nothing peculiar other than perhaps an animal that hasn't been seen in the locality for decades and maybe coming back into the population in the areas. So that would make it unusual. So Chad and Kevin and Noah are very good at looking at the honest evidence, and if it's weird after that, then I tend to follow what the guys are saying, because if they can't find a rational explanation, then I'm very interested in looking at what the possibilities really are.
And that was one of the things that I think really drew Kevin and Noah and myself to this, is that, yes, we, for just simplicity's sake, we label it as a Bigfoot-like creature. But by all accounts, it seemed to be so much different, that it had more of a coned head, as you alluded to earlier, Paul, the flappy ears. And one of the witnesses back in the 1940s said it had a face like a steering wheel, that it was that big. So it really sets it apart from all these other Bigfoot-like creatures that we get so many reports of, not only with the light-colored fur versus the darker, the black. So many things stand out about it that it seems to fit into a Bigfoot type category, but on the other hand, not really.
And then you have things like the red glowing eyes, you know, that, I mean, that almost puts it into the realm of the paranormal rather than, you know, an unknown animal. And, you know, and there's all kinds of things down there. There's the Tuttle Bottoms monster, which is just about an hour's drive away. There's the Enfield Horror, which was also a red-eyed creature that walked on three legs. I mean, what do you mistake that for? I mean, there's just so many strange occurrences down there.
Yeah, it certainly seems to attract the weird and wonderful in that area. The key flap here, I think, starts in sort of the summer of 1972 in the town of Cairo, which is one of those wonderful things I like, that area seems to have a lot of Egyptian named towns for some particular reason, which is always one of those wonderful little facets of American history that I love discovering, especially when usually I read your books or speak with you guys, that you take me to these places that I've never even heard of until a monster turns up, and that's half the fun, I suspect. So I believe it's Leroy Summers is out for a jog, and this is one of those wonderful witness reports where you think, why on earth are you running towards it? You know, turn around, go around it, wherever. But he's one of those people that he just thinks, oh, that's a bit weird. And then the closer he gets to it, he thinks, yeah, that's really weird. So from that point, it seems Murfreesboro, it seems to start with a trickle of sightings and experience. I think there's two or three that the rest of 72, and then 1973 seems to be the year where the big muddy monster says, hello, I'm here.
I think the Riverside boat landing sighting of 73 got a lot of attention because it was very creepy. Lovebirds were parked in a boat ramp area, secluded. It had been heavily flooded. They were just getting acquainted with one another for the evening when this seemingly giant monster comes out of the water, caked in mud from its bottom half, growling or shrieking like something they had never heard of. I mean, that in itself is terrifying as it walks towards their car. They hightail it out of there as fast as they can and go down to the police station and make the report. But I think there was an aspect of gossip and sensationalism to the story because they were together, but one of them was married to someone else. So I think that little tidbit is one of the reasons why it got so much publicity, because it was a bit of a scandal that these two had to be telling the truth. Why would they risk their adulterous affair if they hadn't seen this giant monster?
Yeah, I mean, that's what's always struck me about that witness report, is these guys were taking a risk, because as you say, they could have been there, but they weren't supposed to be with the people they were with.
Yeah, I completely agree, and that going right to the police station instead of just leaving, you're in the presumed safety of your vehicle. You can just head home. But instead, they go to the police station, and the police take it seriously, unlike so many other sightings of cryptids around the world, where they go and investigate. And one of the other aspects of the creature that stood out is the growls or the shrieks it was making seemed to go up and down like a police siren in its pitch and tone. Hmm. And that was something that the junkyard sighting from 88 had the same thing. The witness Bob said that it was going like a police siren, loud and then a little bit lower and then shrieking. So whatever this thing was, it seemed to be using the same tactics over the years.
Yeah, that gives it all credence. And I know that Larry Tincher, who was one of the officers who reported, who went on the investigation at the time, ended up becoming the chief of police, I believe, of Murfreesboro, and he still thinks something weird went on that night, because obviously that's the night where they found these strange prints, and I know there's a picture of them in the book, and you referred to them in the film as well, Joe, that obviously it shows that something quite large had been there and then moved out, and obviously you've got the vacuum that's kind of damaged whatever was there. But as you all say, clearly the police took it seriously enough. These people were frightened enough to risk, you know, the scandal of their illicit affair coming to light, and didn't care. And that, for me, gives that whole incident a real level of credence, because if you thought it was somebody mucking about, once again, even if it is somebody mucking about, he's got no idea if Randy's got a gun in that car, for the greatest respect. And if, you know, he might have thought it was the husband coming to scare them or whatever, you know, whatever. You're going to do what you have to do to protect yourself in that kind of situation, which is why I think when you look at that incident, they clearly felt concerned enough to just think, damn it, we don't care what happens from here on in.
And this was never put into the public at the time, but one of the officers that arrived that evening, when they got there, they could smell an odd smell in the air, and they heard the weird growls as well, so much so that one of the officers dropped his revolver, his pistol, in the woods and was too frightened to go back in to get it. They had to go back in several hours later to grab it. And again, obviously, for many reasons, that was not shared with the public at the time. That didn't come out publicly until Kevin and Noah and I started interviewing these officers, and they told us that it had happened, and they kind of joked about it now, but you could still kind of see the stress and terror that was on their face.
Mm. And I think as a filmmaker, that's one of the strong aspects that drew me into this story, is it just wasn't a collection of people saying, hey, I saw something. This is documented by the authorities, and not just one occasion, but multiple occasions. There's more information in the book. There's another incident in Riverside Park that happened that is detailed in the book as well. And so just all that documentation really drew me in, and because it makes the story more authentic and believable to me.
Christian Barrell's incident as well is one of those that on first glance you go, oh, well, he's 5 years old. But what I've always been impressed with Christian's responses, he's never tried to kind of exaggerate it. It's not grown into something out of control. He's very honest that he says, I can't really tell you what it was. I just know it was big and white and it made me feel scared. And he still says the same thing nearly 50 years later. Whereas often where we get people prone to exaggeration or whatever, by the time they've grown up, it's a completely different story to what it was. And Christian, to his credit, has basically carried on being, and I don't mean this disrespectfully to Christian, it's still a very vague response, but he's talking more about his emotional response, because it frightened him. And that's the key thing for him, I think. And he still feels that clearly when he's talking to you guys in the film.
I love his story. I really do, because like you said, he sticks to it, and he's not like trying to exaggerate. But not only that, his story leads into other accounts. There was other witnesses that night. So to me, you know, yeah, I'm thinking the kid's 3 years old. What the heck is, how are you supposed to believe that? But it was just part of the story, because again, that same night, the neighbors saw it. And then there was a dozen police officers out there tracking it. So I love his story.
And to me, Christian was one of the highlights of the research, meeting him and getting to know him. And the fact that, unlike so many other people who have encountered this, especially when they're young, by the time they get to adulthood, they want nothing to do with the story. They're sick of it. It's defined their lives. They want no part of it. But Christian has embraced it because it's something that happened to him, and he's looking for answers just like everybody else is. And again, I think it illustrates another point that Kevin and I and Noah, when we weren't able to talk with Christian before the book came out, he showed up to one of our book signing presentations and introduced himself, and then we got to know him. And it also shows how this research changes over time. For the book, we relied on all of the newspaper accounts and all of the media accounts of that day that had him listed as a 5-year-old. So that's what we thought. But when we talked with him, he was 3, almost 4 at the time. So it shows that even when this research is quote unquote completed, we're still getting new information. The story's still morphing, progressing, and changing. And Christian, you know, he embraces it, which is a rarity in this field.
Yeah, because as you say, Christian's encounter is kind of a precursor, because obviously, I believe the same day, is it Randy and Cheryl have their encounter where they, once again, you have a couple of adults who are terrified, who end up calling the authorities. And we have one of the stranger aspects of this, that somebody turns up with a police dog to track it. I think the dog's called Reb. And this is often interesting, especially when you look at comparable Bigfoot stories and encounters over the years from across the US and Canada. This dog doesn't want to go anywhere near where this monster's been at all. How did you find that kind of aspect to the case? Because once again, you've got people reporting a big creature. They can't quite make out what it looks like. It seems to be, and obviously we'll come across this in some of the other accounts, it seems to show a level of intelligence because it's just far away enough to not be recognisable. It's kind of skirting the lights and things. So once again, you have something that doesn't seem to be acting like an animal, because it's showing a level of intelligence that perhaps a bear I've heard people claim Bigfoot sightings are cows, for goodness sake. How anybody can mix that up, I don't know. But regardless, once again, you have this, and they're so scared, they end up calling the authorities. The authorities turn up, and once again, you get a really weird response from an animal.
Yeah, and again, there's more detail about the incident in the book, and then just for pacing purposes and time purposes, we couldn't put everything in the film, obviously, but there was, when they were tracking the animal, whatever it was, there was like a slimy substance on plants, like on the trail, kind of indicating that what I assume, like maybe it came out of the river or water, and they were finding traces of that as they were tracking it. So there was obviously something there. It wasn't just imagination, in other words. There was a physical thing that they were tracking. And yeah, I do think it's strange that the dog didn't want anything to do with it. Again, it could be a bear, but that area is not really known for bear, and it hasn't been for a long time.
Yeah, so Randy and Cheryl are just out on the back porch, and they see this thing just off on the edge of their property, and it scares them so much, the police are called. Every single officer on the police force showed up that evening, and the dog, the tracker, it was a great tracking dog, and the handler was so upset because the dog tracked this thing down to an old barn, a shed-like structure, and it refused to go in, to the point where the handler even grabbed the dog and threw it in, and the dog still came back whimpering, refusing to go inside. And these dogs are trained for the tracking purposes, and my only wish was that they would have scooped up some of that slime or river muck that was on the plants and kept it for evidence, but we talked to one of the officers that was tracking through the area that night, and he said they were on high alert. They didn't necessarily all believe it was some sort of monster, but they had no idea what they were dealing with, whether it was some unknown species, a known species that could be deadly, or some deranged lunatic running around. So they were on alert for any of those possibilities.
And when we were talking to Christian, he also told us that a lot of the people in the neighborhood speculated that whatever it was might be living in the basement of a house that was under construction in their neighborhood. He said this was in the 1970s when that neighborhood was fairly new, and a couple houses down, there was a house under construction. The foundation and basement had been dug out and built, and he said that people found signs that something big had been kind of walking around down in that foundation, or kind of holing up down there. So they were theorizing that maybe it was, you know, sleeping its nights down in there or something.
And remember, this was only 24 hours after the boat landing sighting. So the town was still on high alert, and now it wasn't at a public park, but a suburban kind of neighborhood of where there could be more danger to a lot of kids playing around. So I think the officers took it very seriously. And it started off as maybe a joke down at Riverside, but certainly turned into something that should be more feared.
Very much so. And this is the other aspect about all these reports as well. Clearly the police were taking these guys very seriously, because often when we have situations like this, and I'm sure we've all read situations where, you know, locals start seeing strange things, and the authorities will try and poo-poo them and say, oh, you know, what you've been drinking, how long you've been out, where have you been, you don't know what you're talking about. And yet here, one of the things that's always struck me about this case is the police seem to take it very seriously.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, that's a great reason as a filmmaker to do this story is, you know, if you have the authorities believing in something's happening, then it's definitely worthwhile. It's not just some people claiming to have seen something and that's the end of the story. There's documented evidence. You can go on the internet and look at the Big Muddy Monster folder that the police department has uploaded, and it's just full of everything that they discovered and what other people, you know, think and things like that. But it's amazing and fascinating to me that the entire police department, I mean, it's a small police department, but they were all out there because they believed in it.
That folder was one of the biggest surprises while researching this whole case. I mean, in movies and stuff like The X-Files or whatever, you know, science fiction shows, you always have these investigators, you know, pull out this file that says, you know, vampires or, you know, Satanists or whatever the case that they're looking into. And you're like, oh, that never happens. You know, they don't actually have a big folder that says that. And sure enough, when I went down to the Murfreesboro Police Department and started asking questions, and because I'd heard that they had a file, and I didn't really know if that was true or not. And they're like, we sure do. And they pulled me back into the records room. And sure enough, they had this huge brown folder that was a good 2.5 inches thick that just said Big Muddy Monster in bold marker right on it, just like you'd see in a movie. And it was loaded with stuff. Not only was it loaded with sketches from eyewitnesses, but it had some of the actual photos from the scenes that they investigated, like the footprint pictures. And beyond that, it was packed with letters that people had written the police department over the years, talking about their experiences seeing Bigfoot and all kinds of other stories, too, of people saying, you know, don't shoot it, don't hurt it, it doesn't mean anyone any harm. Just all kinds of people like writing in from around the country and the world that just were really taken up by the case.
I mean, I find that really interesting, especially that, you know, 40 years later, that file's still there. So that alone, once again, Kevin, gives it a lot of credit, because clearly it still means a lot to them, because why would you keep that otherwise?
Exactly. I mean, we talk to a lot of police stations, you know, doing the research that we do for our various projects. And a lot of times what we always hear is like, oh, we don't have that anymore. You know, we got rid of that, or we held on to it. We did have it. We held on to it for a few years, but now it's no longer important, so we got rid of it. Or, you know, we were digitizing things, and that was no longer important or relevant, so it was pitched. So, you know, we get any number of excuses or reasons for why it's not around anymore. So to actually see it in this case was pretty amazing.
Yeah, because I think when I saw that file, the first thing I thought about was when Linda Godfrey starts digging into the Dogman case, and they've got the werewolf file. And I thought, well, that again gives it credence. You're thinking, well, surely they are, whether they're officially acknowledging it or not, behind the scenes, they're clearly collecting as much evidence as they can, because they think something strange is going regardless.
Yeah, that werewolf folder, that was the first thing I thought of too when I saw it. That's exactly right.
The other interesting aspect of this is this seems to be the peak of it, and we get a couple more incidents that happen. I think the next major incident that occurs is one of those wonderful teenage situations where you think, oh, I wish that had happened to me when I was out with my mates when I was 14, where you've got that gang of friends who were out camping at night who seem to have an encounter. But what I always found interesting was that was, and maybe you guys can educate me on this, is why did they start calling it the pump house monster? Did they think it was something else, or was that just that where it was, that's where they called it? And then they realized it may be something to do with what else was going on.
Yeah, that refers to the area in which it was spotted. And oftentimes we found that quite a bit, even though the Big Muddy or the Big Muddy Monster had the name had kind of attached by then. People were still calling it different things based on where it might have been spotted. And I think maybe it foretells that it wasn't the same creature, or maybe they saw it from different angles, or maybe it was the same creature, but they simply just called it for what it was, almost to give it its own branding, if you will.
Yeah, we didn't mention this, but there's a river there called the Big Muddy River.
Hmm.
So that's where the monster got its initial, well, its famous name, because they surmised that it came from the river, or out of the river, traveled the river, so they called it the Big Muddy Monster.
Mm. What I've always been struck about by those guys as well is that they all get terrified and run off, and then obviously, you know, safety in numbers, they go, oh, yeah, you know. I mean, to be fair, I'd probably have done the same. I'd have run off and then, you know, try to regain my composure and think, you know, well, hang on a minute, we've got a monster here. Let's see what happens in, you know, classic Scooby-Doo fashion. Let's try and get famous here. And once again, what strikes me about that incident is the kids don't exaggerate it. They don't make it too ridiculous. I know we're talking about an 8-foot monster on the run, but their story's quite matter of fact as well, isn't it?
And you find that quite a bit, that you would think if somebody's hoaxing it, they're going to come up with the most terrifying, the most bizarre details that they can to really hook it into people's minds. But what we're finding, not only with that sighting, but many others, is people, if anything, are almost downplaying it, as though they're trying to rationalize it within their own minds, that they don't embellish the details, even when given the chance to, by leading reporters asking, you know, leading questions or trying to make it more fantastic of a sighting, they often refuse to jump on it.
Hmm. Hmm. Yeah, it is remarkable. As daft as it sounds, it's remarkable in its blandness, because it's very matter of fact.
Yeah, just the facts.
Mm, yeah. And I think that kind of leads into the last big sort of witness report, which is one of those that I think in the book you refer to, it's almost been overlooked or missed, which is the carnival, I think. And this is one of the other things that's very interesting, because over the years we've had numerous reports of Bigfoots and Sasquatches being attracted to horses. For whatever reason, they seem to find them very interesting. Whether you buy into the whole hair plaiting situation or not, there are often reports of Bigfoot being sighted near horses for whatever reason. And this is one of them where it seems to appear, cause some confusion in the people that see it, and they're not really sure what happens. It goes away, and then later on, about 4 hours later, it returns for whatever reason. Did you kind of find any parallels to that going in the area, that this was the first kind of animal creature interaction, other than, you know, the certain reactions that dogs had had?
Well, I think outside of the livestock that were mauled by some creature, yeah, it seems to be the first interspecies interaction, if you will. And I think it also illustrates that outside of the junkyard sighting, where you could make an argument that the thing was aggressive or might be looking to harm someone, the creature in every other sighting, the only reason people thought it was scary because of its physical dimensions. It didn't do anything that would make you think that it was going to harm you. And same with the ponies, the horses that it was looking at, that the carnival workers late at night saw it kind of on the edge, almost as though it was curious about what these things were, staring at it with a curious look. But it wasn't harmful. It wasn't trying to attack the animals in any manner. So it seems to showcase this ability to terrify without being terrifying.
It seems to be more curious than anything. Like you say, it's not aggressive. I mean, obviously it's making some unearthly sounds that are causing people to be quite frightened. And as you say, because of its stature, it's clearly a very imposing creature, whatever it is. And yet, despite coming close to lots of people in different scenarios and different areas, nobody sees it physically attack them or attempt to do so.
And I'm a big fan of carnival and circus folklore and legends. And I love about the carnival sighting is that it was spotted a couple times, but the proprietor of the carnival refused to report it to the authorities. The reason being is that, like a true carny, he thought it would scare away his customers. So he waited until almost the end of the carnival, when it was almost mentioned by chance to an officer, that the report even surfaced. And it was only a few days after the Riverside Park sighting and the backyard sighting of Randy and Christian and others. So a few days later, it's back at the carnival, which is near Riverside Park at the time. And again, the carnival workers kept it to themselves because they didn't want to scare away. Who cares if people are attacked? We need ticket sales.
Well, yeah, and I suppose you would think if they were being cynical about it, you know, everybody's going monster mad in the area. You want to bring more people in, sell a few more tickets. You tell them the monster's there. You might get a free show if you turn up and see it.
Right, that's a really great, good point. You know, as a skeptic, if my side where I'm like, is Bigfoot possible? I would think if it is, like, to me, it's an undiscovered primate. So all these actions, interactions with humans is like a typical animal. I mean, you don't have bear coming out of the woods and attacking people, right? I mean, or other animals, unless they're after food. If they know that there's food there, then they might try to get at you a little bit. But for the most part, it has the same reaction as your typical wild animal.
Yeah, very well. Most of the times you see human bear interactions, the bear's usually going for the food, not the person.
Right. I mean, there could have been some good corn dogs at that carnival or something.
Yeah, absolutely. Or it might have a hankering for some candy floss, whatever. And that really seems to be the last major interaction during this period. It does seem to be quite, I mean, this is often the thing I find about these stories, especially as you refer to Momo and the Enfield Horror and others such. They seem to be very short periods of time where a lot happens and then it just kind of drifts away again, because I know over the rest of the 1970s there's a lot of sort of sightings here and there. But it seems that people aren't really connecting that to what's gone on over the summer of 73, are they?
I think that kind of gets into more of what Kevin writes about in the book, and kind of, I don't know if he believes it or whatever, about how there's a little bit more mysterious things going on than just a physical creature.
Yeah, I mean, I consider myself an open-minded skeptic, you know, like Chad. And, you know, I at the end of the day, I really don't know what this thing is, because it, you know, it displays characteristics of the paranormal, you know, like the red glowing eyes, you know, and all the other phenomena that happens down there, you know, outside of this case. But then at the same time, like you were pointing out with the ponies, you know, it also exhibits characteristics that, you know, flesh and blood animals do too. You know, for instance, Murfreesboro is known for having all kinds of apple orchards. There's orchards all over the place. And a lot of Bigfoot researchers know that they tend to attract sightings of Bigfoot because it's a plentiful food source, same reason they attract deer. You know, so is that why it's been seen around Murfreesboro? I don't know. And to your point, Paul, you know, it's, you know, why that year and then why did it vanish? You know, one of the things that I point out in the book is the spring prior to that summer of sightings in 73, they had a lot of flooding, like a really, really bad flooding in the area. The Big Muddy River, you know, was over its banks and everything. And so one of the things that we theorize is, you know, there are a lot of caves in this area.
Mm.
And so maybe this creature, for whatever it is normally a cave-dwelling creature for, you know, the majority of its time, or perhaps it only comes out at night. It's possible that maybe those caves were flooded that year, forcing it out, you know, to be walking out and looking for different food sources, or expanding its range, you know, beyond what it would normally do, and therefore being, you know, spotted by people when it would normally be underground most of the time. You know, maybe that's why it's white, because it spends a lot of time underground. You know, we really don't know. I mean, it's one of those things where you can keep questioning it forever and keep finding more anecdotal evidence and, you know, and things here and there, but it's one grand mystery is really what it is.
Yeah, because it often strikes me when we have these incidents, and I mean, not obviously, as you've uncovered in the book and Joe touches on in the films, this seems to be kind of like a cyclical event in the area. There is something that turns up every so often, which may be, as you say, connected with what went on in the spring of that year with the heavy rainfall and the rivers bursting its banks and whatever. And clearly that had a big effect, because, you know, there are numerous mentions to how much mud was on the riverbanks still, even after the river had subsided back to what you would consider its normal levels. So it is intriguing that there seems to be, are these incidents related, is it down to something happening in the locality that forces it out, flushes it out, as it were, to start interacting and terrifying the locals? Or is it just coincidence? And I think it's good to look at these options, because there has to be some reason, because it doesn't, you can't just turn up. I mean, why would it just turn up? There has to be something that makes it more visible, if that makes sense.
You know, maybe it's just migrating, and, you know, you know, the sightings in the decades before that weren't exactly the same description. So maybe there's more of them and they just migrate through that area.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and as we know with normal breeds of animals, you know, you can say dogs, but all dogs don't look the same, as you will testify yourself there, Joe, with two cats, you know.
Right.
They're cats, but they don't look the same. They're both completely different colors, aren't they?
Absolutely. And most people think of Bigfoot as just a big brown ape-like creature. But, I mean, if you get into the stories, they're all kinds of colors, white being one of the rarest, but, you know, you got reddish, you got blonde, you got different shades of brown, you got black. So doesn't necessarily disprove or prove anything, but very could well be a variety of them.
I think one of the things I like about this period as well is Jessica Van Pelt. And I love Jessica's story for two reasons. One, she's still got that cast of what's left. But it's the fact that she says, oh, yeah, I used to take it to show and tell at school. I mean, I wish I'd have had somebody like that at my school who would bring things like that in rather than the usual, oh, look at my hamster Steve or whatever, you know? And I think she's, once again, the thing that strikes me about everybody in the film is that everybody's very matter of fact. And Jessica's the same. And yet she still clearly has a lot of emotion attached to this, because I think it was her dad that caught this cast, so she's kept that, I think, primarily as a memory of her father, as well as that period in time. So How did you find Jessica and how she remembers the incidents? Because I don't think Jessica was actually a witness, but it seemed it was going on all around her.
Yeah, that's correct. So I found out about Jessica through Tony Gerard. He's the biologist that's in the film, because, you know, we were trying to find more people that might have had some kind of direct connection with a sighting or some kind, or had some kind of proof. And Tony told me that he knew of someone that might still have a print, and he really stressed the might part, because it had been a long time since he'd heard about it, but he thought he'd get me in contact with her, and so he did. And I stopped by her place, and, you know, to talk to her about it, and sure enough, you know, she still had this print, you know, from the 1970s. And Jessica, she's the mayor of her town, so, you know, she's she's a respected person in town, and she's still, even, you know, with that, she's still willing to come out and talk about Bigfoot. You know, it's, she doesn't mind at all.
Yeah, that's my kind of mayor.
What's cool is since it's been out and released, I've gotten people, you know, messaging me their different stories about it. So her father made the cast, but two of her uncles have contacted me and said, yeah, they were there, you know, her father's brothers. Mm. And they were there. And one of them was like, he said there was a track line. It wasn't just one footprint. There was many footprints. And he goes, I don't know what it was, but there was definitely a trail there, you know, which, again, he was just matter of fact. He wasn't trying to exaggerate it or say, oh, yeah, there's a Bigfoot trail. Mm-hmm. He just basically just told the story as it is.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I love about it. Everybody's very, you know, the story's very simple. It's, this is what happened. This is what we saw. This is what we've got. Take it or leave it.
Yeah, and that's how I wanted to present it as well. I didn't want, you know, when we were talking before we started filming, and I just said, you know, I don't want some, like, we're out in the woods, oh, what's that? What's that snap? Or what's that noise? Type of over-the-top exaggeration. I wanted to be very respectful of the story of the people involved and take it seriously. And I think when you do that, it gives it more credence instead of, you know, trying to pull the wool over someone's eyes.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think it'd be quite remiss of me, because I think one of the aspects of all this is the incident that happens in 1988. Once again, 15 years after the Big Flap, and we have the gentleman, I think his name's Bob Reber, in his salvage yard. And Bob, there's a few things about this, is that Bob's initial incident is clearly quite a frightening event, but there's some of the things that you hear quite a lot about people interacting with weird things is, you know, his mate's got a gun, but he tells him not to shoot it because he might make it angry. So clearly they don't know what they're dealing with. How was Bob now? I mean, obviously it's 30 years ago. And once again, you've got somebody who's still steadfast in their belief that they experienced something very, very odd.
Bob's story's awesome. Bob, and he, again, he just tells it like it happened to him, as he believes it happened to him. And, you know, I saw a like a little 15-minute thing on TV where this is about 15 years old, the program. It was on Discovery or Travel Channel or something. It was an interview with Bob about the incident. And he pretty much tells the story the same way as he told us, you know. And that was 15 years ago. So his story hasn't changed. He may forget an incident or whatever, but I think Bob's very believable. I love his story. It's kind of like you said, almost more of the classic scary story about Bigfoot. I mean, did it actually attack him? No, but just the way they reacted to it is pretty much how I would react, I would think. To get the heck out of there.
You know, Bob's segment in the film, I think, is probably one of my favorite parts of the whole film, because when Bob is recounting what happened to him, I mean, even after all this time, you can see the impact that it had on him. You can just read it right in his face. I mean, he's still, to this day, he's still creeped out by what happened to him. You know, I don't want to call it trauma, but, like, you know, it really affected him, and you can see it.
And Bob, again, was one of those witnesses who claimed it sounded like a police siren going up and down as it screamed. And Bob and his security guard, when they were encountering it in the dead of night in this old junkyard straight out of a Hollywood B-horror movie set, and his security guard wants to shoot it, and as you mentioned, Bob rightly said no, it might make it angry, but they tried to lure it back because they had a shed at the edge of their junkyard with some motion detection lights. So they tried to lure it back, and as they were walking back, still watching it, said the entire time they saw it, it seemed to be mumbling or talking to itself in some unknown language. But when they tried to lure it under the light so it would trigger the light and they could get a better view of it, It seemed to show some sort of intelligence and avoided the light and went around it as though it knew what they were up to. So again, not your typical animal-like behavior.
Well, in the Bigfoot community, we know that as samurai chatter.
Yeah.
So that's been reported many times, which I think that's one of the creepiest things about it. Didn't Ron Moorhead get some of that in the Sierra Sounds, that samurai chatter? I believe mm-hmm. so. Yeah, that stuff, that's like the creepiest thing you could hear in the middle of the woods, I would tell you.
And this is, again, another account of the glowing red eyes that lit up the junkyard. And Bob was adamant that it wasn't a reflection of light, that the red was originating from the creature, emanating from the eyes, which terrified him. And he said, even when we interviewed him for the show, which I think of all the reviews I've seen of the show, which, you know, everyone thinks is fantastic, but they love Bob's interview, probably because I'm the one who did it. But anyway, but no, his story, he's just so genuine, and he's still, those red eyes, he told us, they still stuck with him 30 years later. And Joe mentioned earlier that, yes, there are tiny little details of the story that using the original newspaper accounts I reminded him of, which 30 years past, you're going to have to remind any of us what happened to great detail. But he stuck with this story. Mm. Even more so, he finds it more puzzling today than it was 30 plus years ago.
Yeah, I think the aspect I really like about it is that obviously they're quite frightened by everything, and they've managed to retreat back inside his shed out the way. Because that's the other thing. This thing starts creeping up towards them, doesn't it? They're trying to get out of the way, and it's just slowly moving towards them, which adds a whole air of creepiness to this encounter. And they ring the family to come and help them. And I think it's in the book that didn't one of the family members bring some toilet roll because they thought they were pulling their legs, and they said, oh, well, here you are, you scaredy cats, have it. And clearly, whatever this was, didn't want Bob to get embarrassed, because then it turns up and scares everybody else.
It really did. It started banging on the walls of the shed, and Kevin and I were at the shed, and it's a creepy place. It's a garage. I had a junkyard on the outskirts of town. Again, just something straight out of a horror movie. But Bob was certain that it wasn't trying to harm him in the matter of, he said, based on its size and possible strength, it could have easily busted through the door. But he thought it was more trying to terrify all the people inside of the shed rather than harm them, more of a psychological scare.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, it's a fabulous story. I mean, what I'd really like to know, and obviously you've kind of mentioned this, Joe, is, and I would imagine it's the same for you, Chad and Kevin, as always, when something like this comes into the public domain and perhaps some people aren't aware of it or don't know it as well as they should, people suddenly start to go, well, actually, this happened to me as well. And I know, like you mentioned, Joe, about Jessica's uncles getting in touch. Have any of you had more reports come since then? Because often when you bring a case like this into the public domain, you tend to find more stories coming out.
Yeah, I've definitely, a handful of people, again, have messaged me, and some of them say, well, my dad was involved with the case, or even more recent, I saw it, you know, not too long ago type of thing. But most of them don't want to be interviewed, which kind of sucks because it'd be fun to do some follow-up stuff, you know. Hmm. They're not out trying to get fame or want to be a part of it. They're just, I guess, it's almost like therapy for them, you know, just to let other people know that, yeah, I've had a sighting too, and maybe I'm not crazy. Again, I'm a skeptic. I don't necessarily believe. I kind of believe more in maybe they're misidentifying something or whatever. But if it's true, I mean, that's something probably that would disturb you for a long time, maybe forever.
Yeah. Well, maybe like you say, Jerry, it is some kind of therapy, because it's one of those situations, I think, that sometimes if you've had an encounter and you're on your own, Who the hell are you going to tell that to? Who's going to believe you? Because like we've said with Bob, his family thought he was winding them up, and that's why they turned up with the toilet roll for him. So I think often when somebody realises that they are not alone, they do feel confident enough to come forward and say, well, actually, that happened to me as well.
I can't believe we got as many people on camera as we did, to be honest with you.
Well, I think that's the other testament to it as well, is that, you know, and I've mentioned this with Chad and Kevin and other people when we're talking about creatures like this, is that it's always nice when a town or a city embraces its legend. And obviously Murfreesboro seems to have done that, because I know it's got beers and it does a fun run and other events as well. And I know in the film you mentioned the fact that they're going to build a statue now, aren't they?
Oh, that's amazing. I'm trying to talk the mayor into doing like a Mothman festival. I mean, he admits, yeah, we'd like to use this for tourism purposes. And they're like trying to revitalize the town. They're building a new hotel complex, and that's where the Big Muddy Monster statue is going to be. He told me they're making a Big Muddy Monster road. Yeah, they love the legend, you know. In Point, is it a Mothman festival in Point Pleasant?
Yes.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. So there's not probably less people there than there is in Murfreesboro, or close to the same. And it draws in thousands of people every year, sans COVID, of course. But if Murfreesboro could do that, I think it'd be pretty popular. I mean, there's other festivals close nearby, but our conferences and things like that. So I think it'd be a great place to hold something like that, for sure.
And places really benefit by having those sort of anchor points to various legends, you know, because it's one thing to go to a town and be like, okay, you know, this legend happened here. You know, especially legends that happen in multiple spots around town, or perhaps it's unknown exactly where the location took place. You just know that it happened in this town. And so what ends up happening is people just kind of drive through the town and they're like, okay, we're here, but what do we do with that? You know,
yes.
When you have those anchor points, like a statue, like Mothman or whatever, people go to that point. They get their picture taken with it. They share it on social media. They talk about it. You know, it's like a rite of passage, you know, and then they really feel like they're part of that legend, that they've been there. Not just like, well, I'm in the vicinity. You know, that's that anchor point. And we've been trying to raise money also for the town of Van Meter, Iowa, too, to do with something similar with the Van Meter visitor legend, you know, create a statue or of something of that sort. Because I think it really is a draw that brings people in, and it just, you know, celebrates those legends and hopefully makes them stick around a lot longer.
Yeah, there's actual places were things like Riverside Park where you can, that was pretty creepy. And when I first was there, by the way, I mean, you're like there where something allegedly took place, and you could just looking at the area, you're like, oh, I can kind of see that, you know? So, I mean, there's points of interest to go to where things actually occurred, which I think is phenomenal.
Yeah. And I think this day and age, like Kevin refers to there, you know, for somebody like me in the UK, I know where Point Pleasant is because of Mothman. You know, I know that where I know folk in Arkansas because of Boggy Creek. These are small towns in America that outside of the US, most people would never have heard of them. at all if it wasn't for this. So why shouldn't you embrace it and celebrate this wonderful legend? Because it's quite a unique one as well in the pantheon of cryptids. You know, this is a creepy creature that seems to just like winding people up.
One of the reasons I was so excited to be part of this project is that film reaches a much broader audience than books can ever do, just the way it is. So our book came out in 2019, but I think this film is going to, and it already has drawn up more witnesses, people who come out of the woodwork now, they feel more comfortable, but also it spreads a legend and I think gives the Big Muddy Monster legend some notoriety that it deserves. And I think that only happens with a film. When you look at the Mothman Festival pre and post the Mothman Prophecies movie, it's not even comparable. It wasn't the legend it is today without that movie. So I think when Joe does things like this and movies and documentaries, they're adding a big service to these towns and to the legends themselves, keeping them around forever.
Yeah, absolutely. And that should be celebrated.
I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that the Big Muddy case was one of Lauren Coleman's first or early investigations. Lauren used to live in central Illinois, so that was one of his first investigations. So, I mean, you had some pretty famous cryptozoologists out there. I mean, this isn't just your normal Bigfoot story. There's a lot going on to it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, gentlemen, thank you for your time in discussing this brilliant documentary and obviously Chad and Kevin and Noah's wonderful book, which is a fabulous companion to it. So then, Joe, where can everybody watch this and enjoy it as much as we have?
For right now, it's on Amazon Prime exclusively. And I don't believe you have to have Prime in order to watch Prime. And also, if you go to Facebook and look up the Creature from Big Muddy page, there's links to where you can purchase the DVD. Right now, I'm doing some giveaways, so maybe you can go to the page and get yourself a free copy. That's where it is so at the moment.
Excellent. You going to get Chad dressing up again for you?
I would, but he gave away most of the suit.
Don't worry, I can get more. If it comes to dressing up as furry things, count me in.
Well, I'm not sure where we should go with that, Chad. But anyway, right. So, Chad, Kevin, what's next for you guys? What are you up to?
Yeah, I'm hunkering down right now. The only place to see, hear, or watch me is Creature from Big Muddy, the documentary. So if people want to find me, you're going to have to do it through that little-known company called Amazon. Yeah, well, I've got a new book coming out on supernatural dares, these places that have supernatural reputations where you have to do something in order for the legend to come true, whether it's knock on a mausoleum to conjure up a demon or sit in the devil's chair to curse your soul, those type of things. So I'm just enjoying my last days here on Earth before these curses provide me ill fate and I'm no longer here.
Yeah, kind of like Chad, I've been kind of hunkering down here because of COVID too, but the silver lining with that whole thing is it allows, you know, a lot of time for research and writing and things like that. So right now I'm kind of working on a book about black dog and hellhound legends in America. So
fantastic. Oh, interesting, because I know obviously that's more often associated with us here in the UK, Kevin. So that'll be really interesting to see just how widespread that is over there.
Exactly. I mean, there's a few books out already about, you know, the UK phenomena, but very little about the same or similar phenomena stateside.
Oh, fantastic. When's that due out?
Hopefully within the next year.
Brilliant. And your book's out in the next couple of months, is it, Chad?
Yeah, it should be out the end of this month, early April.
Fantastic.
If I can mention, if you watch the documentary and you enjoy it, I highly recommend the book. The book has a lot more research and a lot more detail, a lot more information about not only the things you see in the documentary, but just other stories in general. It's a fantastic book as far as information goes about the case.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I've got the autographed copy in front of me on my desk, so I completely agree with what you're saying, Joe. It's one of Kevin and Chad and Noah's fantastic books that they do on these wonderful, weird and unique cases that dot the United States. And obviously, you can get the book through Amazon and through you guys' website, which is batroadslaw.com, I believe.
That is correct.
Yep.
Well, as always, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak with you all. The best of luck with the film, Joe. I hope it gets plenty of downloads, and let's hope it earns you some money before it goes free, my friend. You know, you'd certainly deserve it with the work you've put into it, because it's a wonderful film, beautifully shot, with some fabulous witness interviews. So, once again, thank you all for your time. It's been a real pleasure to speak with you all.
Likewise, thank you.